What's up, everybody? It's your boy Mondo, aka Chunklet the Mongoo, and this is episode 5 of We Talking About Games. I actually had to watch my last YouTube video, podcast to just freshen up. I'm like, how the hell do I even start these? And I thought it was so ironically funny that in the last episode, I was really, really hyped that I got back-to-back episodes and back-to-back weeks of recordings. And between that episode and this episode, it's been like almost a month and a half. I actually think it's been a month and a half, which is so unfortunate. But whatever, we're not gonna get too much in the weeds of that. I've definitely found a schedule that I think is gonna work for recording moving forward. I personally feel like I was just relying too heavily on like my weeknights, a specific weeknight to record. So I think going forward, podcast is going to record on Sundays and I'm going to upload it on Mondays. And we're going to see how that works. I'm pretty freaking positive I'll be able to record this Sunday. So we're definitely going to get 2 weeks back to back again. And let's see how consistently we can keep it going from there. But happy to be back. Happy to be recording again. Life has felt super weird without recording. And sitting down here to prepare to even record this episode has been like, what the hell am I doing? And I don't like that feeling. So let's get back to it. But that said, let's jump into what the hell have I been playing recently? I've been playing a lot of things over the last month and a half, but I'm just gonna focus on like the last 2 weeks. Been playing over the past few days. I've been playing so much freaking Elden Ring. Like the last 3 days have been nothing but Elden Ring for me. I built a new PC over the weekend. Shout out to my younger brother Adonis, who donated his processor and his motherboard, got a new GPU too, and we are moving swimmingly on this side right now. The PC is chef's kiss, lovely. I even got on stream yesterday to see how Elden Ring and was just gonna run on stream because I haven't been able to play PC games and stream them at the same time. My 2080 was just coughing up a lung when I was trying to play games. Specifically when Helldivers 2 came out, I tried to stream that, and my 2080 was like, "Nah, dog, we not doing that here. I don't know who you think I am, but I'm not that guy." And so we upgraded everything. Pretty much the only thing that carried over is my power supply, funnily enough. And so we're moving great on that. Been playing a lot of Elden Ring because I'm not really sure if I'll be able to beat it before the DLC comes out, but I was just a little invigorated to dive back in because my first playthrough, I cut it real short after like the first two bosses. This playthrough is going way better, like way better. So if you want, follow me on Twitch at Chunklet the Mongoo, and I'm more than likely going to be streaming more often now. Because the only reason I really kind of stopped that because I wasn't playing very many things on my consoles, and I just couldn't stream PC games anymore. It kind of sucked. But we back, baby. We back. Also been playing Yakuza Like a Dragon. Bought that on Steam recently too, so I've been playing a lot of that on my Steam Deck specifically. Portable devices are so good for JRPGs, but that's been a lot of fun too. Just love the charm that that game has. Does it remind me so much of Shenmue? Because Shenmue is like one of my all-time faves, but it has some of that in its deep storylines. Shenmue had a certain charm here and there, but it took itself very seriously for most of the game. And so it's like a nice blend. I think it's really good. Really enjoying Yakuza Like a Dragon. Also been playing a lot of Hades 2. I haven't played over like the last week, but when that game dropped, bro, ooh, let me tell you, it's all I could play. I played that thing for like a week straight. And it is so good. Like, man, I wondered how they could make Hades better. And if they could, nah, they could, and they did, 100%. Hades 2 is still in early access for sure, and so I think a lot of things are going to change. I even played a little bit over the weekend, and they recently patched the game to change something in it. I don't want to get too deep into the weeds. I'd love for y'all to experience it yourself, but they changed a few things of it, and that made the game significantly better. So we'll see. We'll see how, I don't know. We'll see how the patches play out. I'm actually looking forward to being on that ride with them to see what changes over time and what ends up being the final game. Because by the time I got on the Hades bandwagon, the game had already released on all consoles and everything like that. So I'm really looking forward to seeing how this game transforms over time. If you don't know, which if you don't know, you haven't been listening to this podcast, but there's emulators on iPhone now. And so I've been playing Pokemon White on the Delta app on iPhone, and that's just been cool. Just been playing it on my commutes to and from work, putting in some time here and there, because it's one of the few Pokemon games I haven't played. So that's been fun. And last week, when I had a little bit of time after the game released, I played a little bit of Hellblade 2, which we're gonna get into it when I get to the Hellblade 2 part of this episode. But I liked it. I like what I played so far. And yeah, and then. Only updates I have for you guys is, as I mentioned earlier, I built a new PC. And so, if anybody who's built a new PC knows, you have to, especially if you're building a new one and you're like, transferring over your hard drive and stuff like that, you have to wipe that hard drive. Especially if you're gonna like upgrade your Windows, which I did. I was on Windows 10, I'm on Windows 11 now. And so, I did a very, very poor job of transferring over my data. And I did not transfer over a lot of stuff. Some of that being the assets for this podcast. Like, I lost the original files for my logo. I lost the original files for my layouts for the YouTube videos and stuff like that. I lost all the episodes I've already recorded, like the first four, those are gone. I could download the audio off Audioboom, and I guess I could technically download the YouTube videos too, but the original files are gone. That was kind of sad when I realized that the other night. And I also lost my Final Fantasy VII Rebirth gameplay and the video that I had already begun editing for my review. And so I have to restart my Final Fantasy VII Rebirth review, which really, really sucks because it was pretty much like ready to go, like especially like right after this episode. I wanted it to be episode six, but I'm not sure that that's gonna happen. So I know on one of my last episodes I said that it was gonna be coming soon, but I'm a dumb dumb and I did not back up all my files. This is a warning to everybody. Please back up your files. It's so crazy because I told my wife 100 times to make sure she backed up her files because that was happening over the weekend, and I myself didn't do it. The irony, man. The irony. Hurts. It hurts. So, anyways, womp womp. Look out for that in the near future because I do definitely want to get that out. I recorded it and I'm going to get that review out. I'll be damned. I'll be damned. But yeah, so what are we going to talk about today? We're going to talk about Hellblade 2 reviews. We're going to talk about Assassin's Creed Shadows. I want to talk about it a little bit. I want to talk about Helldivers 2 sales numbers and Square Enix's sort of new platform, multi-platform strategy. And I don't think that those are necessarily news items that are related in the sense of like, them being alongside one another. But I think they play into a greater idea that I would like to see come to fruition in, exclusives no longer mattering. So kind of want to talk about that a little bit. But the first thing I want to get into is Call of Duty officially, as of today, being announced that it is coming to Game Pass. I'm going to read an article from IGN, just a snippet from it. So this is an article from IGN from Wesley Yenpool. Microsoft confirms Call of Duty Black Ops 6 day one with Xbox Game Pass. In a post on Xbox Wire, Microsoft pointed to its fans. Sorry, God, I can't even read now. It's been so long. Oh my goodness. In a post on Xbox Wire, Microsoft pointed fans to its Xbox Game Showcase event as well as its Call of Duty Black Ops 6 Direct on June 9th, 2024. It's going to be at 10 a.m. Pacific time, so it's 1 p.m. Eastern. That'll likely be in the middle of my workday, but I'll be watching stuff at work, so whatever. There it will share more details on the game and a first in-depth look at gameplay in quote-unquote, it's in its dark new chapter of Black Ops series. Damn, I can't believe that they're already on Black Ops 6. I'm not gonna lie to you. Like, where the hell were 4 and 5? Were 4 and 5 numbered? Like, maybe 4, but was 5 numbered? I'm not sure. I can't remember. That might have been during a time I wasn't playing Call of Duty like that. Microsoft made the announcement alongside a release of a live-action reveal trailer of The Truth Lies. Yeah, I'm not going to get into that. In it, we see world leaders including Bill Clinton, Margaret Thatcher, George H.W. Bush, Colin Powell, and Saddam Hussein. Oh, I said Saddam. Saddam Hussein delivering cryptic speeches. Black Ops 6 is reported to be set during the events of the Gulf War during the early 90s. That's interesting. And I guess what I really wanted to get into, because, you know, whatever. Call of Duty's coming to Game Pass, and, you know, that's just news in of itself. We all know that it's like the number one selling game every year, unless Hogwarts Legacy is coming out that year. I guess, you know, something that interested me about this conversation is, you know, there was a lot of rumors that came out alongside like this announcement before it was like officially announced by Xbox of, you know, apparently there were conversations at Xbox about whether or not they wanted to put the game out on Game Pass, or if they wanted to just sell it a la carte, even on Xbox, because granted, Game Pass isn't on everything. So if you're on PlayStation and if you're on eventually Nintendo consoles, because this is, you know, Xbox made a contract with Nintendo that they're going to bring Call of Duty to them for the next 10 years. I don't know if this one's going to make it to Nintendo on release, but, you know, you're going to sell that game a la carte on PlayStation. You're going to sell it a la carte on Nintendo. You're going to sell it a la carte everywhere, right? Even on Xbox. But, you know, since Game Pass is on Xbox and PC, I imagine there's going to be a large community of people who are just going to say, yo, I got Game Pass. I don't need to buy Call of Duty. I mean, I texted my boys this morning. I was like, God damn it. I'm so happy I don't have to buy another Call of Duty game, because I only buy Call of Duty to play with my boys every now and again. And I hate the fact that I got to pay $70 on release date to play a game that I'm only going to play a couple times a month. Perdida, I'm not letting you out of the room. Stop meowing at me. No, P, I'm not letting you out of the room. I'm so sorry. I can't let her out of the room. There's somebody who's allergic to cats here in my house. And so she's got to suffer, which means I have to suffer, apparently. And so I thought that the rumors of them not bringing it to Xbox were kind of interesting, because one, that would be really stupid. Like, you went out and bought Activision Blizzard for $70 billion, and you're telling me and everybody that potentially this game isn't even going to come to Game Pass? The number one game from Activision Blizzard? Like, this number one game of the industry, this sort of leverage that you would create for having people buy into Game Pass, you're not going to put it there? That makes no sense to me. Like, that is the dumbest thing Xbox could possibly do. But then, in extension of that, people even talking about the fact that, like, Xbox was debating that idea kind of sounds stupid to me. Like, as far as I'm concerned, all of the messaging throughout them acquiring Activision Blizzard was like, yeah, you know, we're buying this to put these games on Game Pass. You know, I have to imagine when you go out and drop $70 billion, you're thinking to yourself, yo, we're putting this game on Game Pass. Like, this is not a debate. You know what I mean? Like, this is part of the reason we're buying it. And so to think that at the last minute they were actually debating it kind of seems ridiculous to me. I saw some people online sort of trying to use that as a means to further dogpile on Xbox executives to say, like, yo, like, they don't know what they're doing over there. And that don't make sense to me, to be honest with you. I think they're not the people who were debating that. Like, if there was anybody in the room at Microsoft saying, yo, why are we doing this? Why aren't we just selling the game a la carte? That was not the people who have been telling us for the past couple of years that these games are coming to Game Pass. It just cannot possibly be those people. If it is, then God damn, are they stupid. But I just don't have any reason to believe that they're that stupid. But then, you know, I'm not going to get into the weeds of it, but, you know, they've recently been, you know, cutting staff over there, but they also recently closed Tango Gameworks and the Redfall creator, which is Arcane Austin, who made games like, you know, I think they made the Wolfenstein games, if I'm not mistaken. But they're most popularly known for like Prey and Dishonored. And they closed those two studios, like two studios that like people adore. And despite Redfall being a failure, that was a studio that still had the potential to make another Prey, to make another Dishonored, to make another game that was critically acclaimed like those. And a Tango Gameworks that just released Hi-Fi Rush last year, which was like your best game, not just last year, but like your best game in years, like critically acclaimed games in years. And you close these studios. And so I don't think that there's a lack of people thinking that Xbox is doing some really stupid shit. And so I can understand the sentiment of like looking at this and being like, why the hell are they even debating this? That's stupid. And in like internally and, you know, within myself, I think it's kind of stupid to think that they were actually debating that. Because, you know, I think we hear rumors and like we think it's a one for one. Like what we heard is exactly what happened. And I'm not really sure that that's really the case. I think in most cases, when you hear a rumor, it usually isn't a one for one. You know, usually, you know, if you were young, well, we're all young, I guess, bad way of putting it. But when we were young, if you were in a class that ever did this experiment, I think I was in sixth grade. Only know because I remember being in that class when the Twin Towers fell. But in my sixth grade class, we did the experiment of like, I'm going to tell you something and you have to tell it to the next person and they're going to tell it to the next person and so on and so forth. And we're going to see what it is the last person heard. And it tends to be that the last person did not hear what I, the first person, told the second person. Often enough, the third person didn't even hear the same thing that I told the second person, right? And so like even the exchange from one person to another, the story already shifts. And so like I always, you know, I think that's why you got to take rumors with a grain of salt. Like, you know, especially because like this isn't like a rumor of like a game being announced, which like that's something that is a one for one. It's either going to happen or it's not going to happen. But like rumors around conversations having happened and the kind of conversations that have happened, that sounds ridiculous to me. And that just, I cannot sit here and believe that. That a room full of executives that just spent $70 billion are sitting down after making the acquisition and saying to themselves, hey, so, you know, I know we've been talking about doing this for like years, but like, hey, are we really gonna do it? You know, like, why would we do it? And so on and so forth. Why the hell would you do it? What the fuck you mean? This is your Stranger Things. This is your Game of Thrones. This is your exclusive piece that is supposed to draw people to Game Pass. And as much as I don't give a shit about exclusive games, that's what you need to sell this product. That's what you need to get people to be like, maybe there's value over here for me. You know, now that you have an MLB The Show on there, now that you have a steady cadence of planned out games coming to Game Pass, exclusive like Xbox games, now you have MLB The Show, Call of Duty, Hellblade just released last week. You have Avowed later this year. You got a Microsoft Flight Simulator update later this year that I'm actually really looking forward to see how that plays on my PC. And you have a bunch of other games that are coming, and that's not even including just the third-party deals you're making and so on and so forth. You have to create value here, but you need that juggernaut, right? Like, I didn't subscribe to Netflix for the odd end movie that's there that I'm going to watch, but that's not why I subscribed to it. I subscribed for Stranger Things. And by the way, just full disclosure, I hate Netflix. I hate everything all these streaming platforms stand for, but it is what it is. I guess that's how we watch TV now. My wife loves Netflix. Anyways, I subscribed for a Stranger Things. I subscribed for a, what's that popular show that just got a season's update right now? Oh God, it's escaping me. The love show that was first following one person and the other person. It's gonna hit me later in the episode, but those are the shows I subscribed to that for. I didn't subscribe to HBO for the random movie that they throw on there. I subscribe for Game of Thrones. I subscribe for oh my God, I hate the fact that names keep escaping me. The dude who made Seinfeld. Oh wow. Ah, oh, whatever, man. The brain farts are killing me. And so are you, Perdida. You're fucking killing me, bro. Leave me alone. I'm trying to record an episode. Stop freaking meowing at me. We ain't going nowhere. Usa. God, bro. Holy shit. Anyways. Long story short, I think it's kind of ridiculous that people were kind of having conversations about that. And I kind of just wanted to, like, get into the weeds of that because... I guess maybe I feel this kind of way because I've worked in corporate communications, like, and like high level corporate communications. Like I was like one person removed from the CEO. Like it was me, my boss, and her boss was the CEO. And so like, I sort of feel like I have a feel for what those conversations are like, what those rooms are like. And by the way, like this is a massive corporation, like the size of like a Microsoft. In that world. And so when I hear the things that people think are happening in the background, I get this large feeling. You know, sometimes I'm just like, yeah, you know what, that probably did happen. But when I hear something like this, I get an overwhelming feeling of like, why do people think this happened? Because there's just no fucking way, unless that room was full of idiots, that is how it went down. Because for me, I just imagine that the way it went down is the executives at Xbox, who have been talking about doing this for years, wanted to do it. And now, unfortunately, because of other things, you know, when you look at the Tango Gameworks closure, I'm not sure that that was a Phil decision. I'm not sure that was a Sarah Bond or a Matt Booty decision. It just, in my head, it can't possibly be. And now that they've purchased Activision Blizzard, They are a larger sector of Microsoft. They make up a larger portion of Microsoft. And so they have more responsibility in Microsoft. Or rather, Satya, the CEO of Microsoft, has a larger responsibility for overseeing Xbox. He has to make more decisions for Xbox than he was before. It's sort of like a, hey, Phil, you can kind of do whatever you want to do. And that's always the way it's been, right? Like you can do whatever you want to do within these bounds. Now it's more of like a, you can sort of do whatever you want to do, but the bounds are a little tighter and I'm going to oversee damn near every decision because this part of the business makes up too much of the profit earning part of our business. And so I imagine that there were some bean counters in the room who were like, yo, why are we doing this? And Phil's like, this is why the fuck we're doing this, my guy. Like, what are you talking about? And I had somebody respond to me on Twitter of like, yeah, but didn't they count the beans? Like, didn't someone already calculate for this before they bought it? And it's like, yeah, no, for sure. Someone probably did. More than likely did. But then you reanalyze it and you look at it again. Who knows if the person who originally counted it is still at the company? And someone else is now there after the acquisition counting it and saying like, yo, wait, why did we make this decision a few years ago if this is what we can do with it? Like, this is why I hear a rumor like that. That again, it's not a one-for-one. It's not a game announcement or this might happen. It's a conversation that happened. And it just doesn't make no sense to me. And so, yeah, anyways, Call of Duty is coming to Game Pass later this year. I think it's slated for, we don't know. I guess we're going to find out more in June, but I imagine it's going to be late October, early November, the usual Call of Duty window. And yeah, I'm looking forward to playing it. I'm not looking forward to the fact that it's Black Ops because I hate Treyarch. I think they make the worst Call of Duty games. And this is another reason why I don't really want to pay $70 for it. And so looking forward to having a fun time with my friends for a couple of days and then putting it down. And I'm going to be even happier that I can spend my $70 on another game. Oh boy. Bevita, sure, bro. Sure. I'm sorry, babe. She just doesn't shut up. I'm sorry. I had to get the cat out of the room. She just won't shut up. She just won't shut up. She's crazy. She's usually really good with the episodes, but I think my wife has company right now. And so I think she's, I don't know, she's being a mañosa. She's just being annoying. She just wants to want. I promise you, before the end of this episode, she will be knocking on my door to let her back in. And I won't be surprised if it's in the next 10 minutes, because that's how she is. God. She's the producer of the show. This is the producer of my podcast, by the way, in case you were fucking wondering. Anyways, transitioning from one Xbox game to another, last week, Hellblade 2 finally released. I feel like it's been forever. But this is Xbox's first big exclusive of the year, and it has been met with some polarizing reception. I say polarizing because I feel like it has been received as a game you either love it for what it is, or you really, really dislike it. And there are so few people who are like right in between. I think there's more people who like it and are just like, yeah, you know, like this is good, or it's really good. More so than there are people who are like, what the hell have they been doing for 5 years? And so Hellblade 2 is currently sitting at a 81 Metacritic and a 7.4 user rating, which I think is really good. I think that's pretty good. Gotten above an 80. And, you know, for Xbox, who has been lacking in the exclusive department, you needed a win with this one for sure. And it's good to see that they got a relative win. And I just want to read off just 2, 3, maybe 4 of the shorthand reviews off of Metacritic to give some examples of how people feel about this game. So I'm going to read off a 100 for Hellblade. And I'm not going to lie, I played a little bit of the game, and I'm not really sure how somebody arrives at a 100. But we're going to read 100 anyways. Despite the backing of a company as large and as well-funded as Microsoft, Ninja Theory have, in my opinion, nurtured their independent spirit and kept it well and truly alive in every facet. It's brutal, it's breathtaking, it's brilliant. If this is independent AAA, quote-unquote, sign me up for more. And that is from Xbox era. But even Eurogamer, which has been pretty critical of Xbox in the past, in the recent past, Hellblade 2 continues Senua's story with grace, confidence, surprising brutality, and thundering conviction. Again, these are shorthands off of Metacritic. Now, I want to scroll past the 100s, 90s, 80s, and I want to get into the 70s, because that's where, especially the low 70s, because I think this is where things get a little more, you know, a little more this is where the polarizing part comes in, I guess. So we're going to go to Forbes. Why not? Senua's Saga, Hellblade 2, is a gorgeous game full of industry-best visuals and cast performances. It is also not terribly fun to play. And let's go to Pure Xbox, who gave it a 72. Senua's Saga, Hellblade 2, is the best-looking video game we've ever played. It sounds incredible. Melina Jurgens acts herself inside out. Yeah, she annihilated this. And on a purely technical level, this is just next-level stuff all around. However, we still don't feel as though extending Senua's plight into a saga is a good idea. We remain unconvinced, and it's because this sequel feels like diminishing returns, as we had worried it might. It's not as vital or as unique in 2024, and it goes for the bombast as a means of smoothing things over, resulting in a good game, an interesting 8-hour romp, but nothing that screams must play. Weak combat and dull puzzles are just more salt in these wounds, unfortunately. And, you know, we could go lower to like some really bad ones, but I could imagine, you could just imagine what some of the more negative reviews are really get into. You know what? I scroll down, I'm gonna read a 50. A joyless slog of barely interactive entertainment and a muddled portrayal of mental illness that just so happens to be the best graphics ever on a video game console. Oof. That's hard hitting right there, But I think just what I read off sort of gives the essence of what makes this game so polarizing. I myself played about an hour of the game, which is crazy because that means I've played a little more than 10% of the game. Some people have beaten the game in 5 hours. Somebody in the review said that it's an 8 hour playthrough. But from most people's conversations online, they have beaten it in 5 hours. There's actually full videos on YouTube of the 5 hour playthrough, full walkthrough of Senua Saga, Hellblade 2. And so I guess at that point I've already played 20% of the game. For me, being 1 hour into the game, I have to agree with everyone here. This is by far the best looking video game I have ever seen. It looks incredible on my Xbox Series X, on my OLED television. It looks incredible on my PC. The sound design is top notch. Like, I mean, oh my goodness. Please don't play this game without a headset. Please don't play this game without headphones. You are doing yourself a disservice. It deserves better than that. It really, really does. And if you don't have headphones, just don't play this game until you have headphones. Like, it's not worth it. And those are two of the things. Well, not two of the things. The sound design is one of those things that carried over from the first game that I absolutely loved. And talk about immersion. It makes you immersed. You are immersed in that world when that audio is hitting the way it hits. I will say, again, I'm not sure what changes after an hour, but my sentiment is so and so with most people in that the gameplay isn't transformative, you know? I'm a huge fan of the first Hellblade. It was such a fun game. You know, it was something that I wasn't really sure I was gonna enjoy, but when I heard the audio design was great, I was like, all right, cool, like let me try this, you know. I fancy myself an audiophile in some ways. And so that was the standout for that title for me. And I absolutely loved it. And it is probably my favorite thing about Hellblade. But my next favorite thing about Hellblade, the first game, was that combat. As simple as it was, as straightforward as it was so good. It was so rewarding. It had a good parry system. And when something hit, it hit. And just the sort of nature of all of those enemies coming at you at once and having to deal with that was just incredible for what it was for that time and so on and so forth. I probably wouldn't be calling it incredible if it was some massive AAA game, but again, for what it was so good. Just so good. And the puzzles, although I feel like they were, not that they were harder than they needed to be, but they were just tougher to solve than they needed to be. The puzzles themselves weren't hard, but it was kind of annoying how hard it was to find the solution. And then when you found it was more of like disappointment that you didn't find it sooner. That was an overwhelming feeling that I carried throughout that game. Because again, I love a hard puzzle, but after a hard puzzle, I usually feel like, oh wow, finally I like figured that out. That's great. After a lot of the puzzles in the first Hellblade, I was just like, man, why didn't that show itself sooner? Why was that the angle that this appeared in, and stuff like that? And where I felt like it took me longer to figure out the puzzle, not because I wasn't good at figuring out the puzzle, but more so the game design of the puzzle. And that was a large sentiment that carried out throughout a lot of reviews and a lot of people who played the game of like, man, these puzzles could be easier, could be done better. And so I have to say that like the combat isn't much better, you know? Like that sucks. That really, really sucks because it was like the one thing I was hoping was going to improve with this game. You know, we've seen so many trailers of this game and a slight walkthrough of it at a Xbox showcase, if I'm not mistaken, is what it was. And so cool, like we knew that the game was going to be groundbreaking visuals. And like one of these reviews said, this is the best looking game on a console. And I imagine on a full-fledged PC, this is the best looking game, period. Unreal Engine 5 is just something else, man. Like, wow. Like, holy fucking shit. The next generation of games are gonna look incredible. But man, did that come at a cost of gameplay? Because I feel like for a game that was in development for 5 years, I feel like they must have spent the most of that 4 years on the visual aspect of this game. And if you've heard me talk about fidelity at all over the past year, you know that I'm not that big a fan of how much we have focused on how good a game looks versus how well it plays. I haven't done enough puzzling in the game to give comments on that, but the wide consensus on them is that they're too easy now, that they're not even puzzles anymore because it doesn't take much thought or effort to solve them. And that's disappointing because for as ridiculously difficult as they used to be, I also didn't want them to just be simple enough to where you didn't actually feel a challenge. And that is the large consensus around the game. And so, there were comments, people talking about it online, obviously. And one comment that I had to someone's tweet, I forget exactly what they tweeted, but like my thought was just like, this is what we get when you focus so heavily on fidelity. Like, this is the best looking video game I have ever seen. Nothing comes close. You can make a debate of like ray tracing here and there and yada yada. I'm talking spec for spec, follicle for follicle. I've never seen a game that looks this good. But that came at a cost. I'm sure that came at a financial cost. And that also came at a cost for a game that feels like it lacks depth, And again, there's obviously two sides. There's people who absolutely love this game and want more of this. And there's another side that is large, but seemingly not as large, that aren't that fulfilled with the game and feel like the past 5 years that they've waited for a sequel for a game that they ended up loving, because I feel like Hellblade, the first one, is like a cult classic. Like, if you played it, you sort of walked away from that like, man, I wasn't expecting that, but that was a blast, And a lot of people didn't play it, and so it's sort of like, I would put it in that category. But man, that's so disappointing. And so, planning on finishing it this week so that I could just give my full review in next week's episode. Give a short review of it, just get into the weeds of it this week. But man, I'm hoping I walk away from it being on the better end of consensus around this game, because I really like the first one, and who knows if they're gonna have a third one. I know there's rumors that Microsoft has already greenlit Ninja Theory's next game that could be another Hellblade. But then I sit around, I'm just like, well, I hope that doesn't take 5 years. And I'm not trying to put a sort of value on how long a game is, because how long a game is shouldn't be the thing that makes it valuable. I think of Assassin's Creed Valhalla and how that game is just overwhelmingly long. The game isn't good because it's long. That game, in fact, is actually, in my opinion, bad because it's so long. And I don't think it's a bad game, but I think if there's one thing that I would point to about that game, like, oh man, if somebody asked me, hey, what do you think is the worst part about AC Valhalla? That it's 70 hours long. That's what I think the worst part about that game is. And so, but I think the opposite spectrum could also be true of like, man, I don't know if a 5 hour experience is all that great either, especially for how long we waited and what we were hoping the game would be. Ultimately, the game is $50 and it's in Game Pass. So if you bought it straight up, it is $20 cheaper than a $70 game that most games are nowadays. So maybe that 5 hour experience isn't a terrible thing. Again, I gotta play it for myself and see what it is. But I think the conversation around it is interesting, around, like, what do we value in gaming? Like, is this game not a successful piece of art? Did Ninja Theory not achieve what they set out to do? And despite it not meeting our expectations, does that make it bad? That it didn't meet our expectations? I'm not necessarily sure about that. And so I feel like when I actually finish the game later this week, I also have to feel like I got to look at it from that lens too. Like I feel like, the night I finish it, cool, that's gonna be great and everything. And I'm gonna have my consensus, but I think I also might have to take a step outside myself and say, was this a great piece of art? Was this a great game? Was this a good journey? Because not every game has to be some super combative thing, or super gamey thing. You'll hear me say over time, like that's a video game ass game, which I love. I love a video game ass game, but I also love a game that gets deeper than that. And Hellblade, the first one, definitely did that. Definitely got deeper than that. And so I'm just, I don't know, very interested to see what my journey is going to end up like. And so tune back next week. Tune in next week to see what my final thoughts on Hellblade 2 is. And I'd love to hear what your thoughts on Hellblade 2 are, on whether or not you liked it, whether you played it, whether you played the first one. And if you haven't played the first one, please go play that first one. Don't let what people have said about Hellblade 2 stop you from playing that first one. That first one is a gem and deserves to be played. It deserves to be experienced because they did some really, really amazing stuff, especially tackling just the conversation and everything around that mental health, around mental psychosis and things of that nature. And so, yeah, so I don't know. That's my thoughts on Hellblade 2. I'm not gonna get too much into the weeds of it. But I guess to get into another controversial topic, Assassin's Creed Shadows recently got announced, and I'm calling them the DEI police. The DEI police have come running for the game. And so, very quickly, Assassin's Creed Shadows has been announced for release this year on November 15th. Super duper looking forward to it because, as a longtime Assassin's Creed fan, I feel like myself and many others have been like, yo, when is that Japan-based Assassin's Creed game coming out? Because I needs that. I needs that. Like, what is good? Like, we've been waiting so long, but it's finally coming. And so, in the game, we're gonna play as one of two protagonists, Yasuke, a black samurai, and a ninja-like female shinobi named Naho. Nao. Yeah. Nao? Yeah. Now. I feel like it's pronounced like now, like right now, but it's not. It's not spelled that way. It's Naoe. But I feel like that's pronounced now. And so this game takes place in Japan, sort of like a feudal Japan, samurai era Japan. And a game has been met with a lot of hate, a lot of controversy. And what do you think it's for? It's for its black samurai, Yasuke. For those who don't know, Yasuke is a real person from Japanese history. There isn't a lot known about him, but I feel like he's popular because he was an African man in Japan at that time, which was very, very rare at that time. And so I'm just gonna read the beginning excerpt from Wikipedia. If we could take that for what it is, I feel like I grew up with my teacher saying, "Yo, don't go to Wikipedia to reference your work. We don't want that." But I have also grown up to realize that like pretty much everything on Wikipedia is right, and they have people, keeping these things up to date, so to speak. And so, Yasuke was a man of African origin who served as a retainer to the Japanese daimyo. Oda Nobunaga, Nobunaga, for a period of 15 months between 1581 and 1582, during the Sengoku period, until Nobunaga's death in the Honnoji incident. Man, I really gotta learn a little bit of Japanese so I can understand how some of these are pronounced and stuff. I've always felt like my Spanish has allowed me to pronounce things better than like a traditional American, But whenever I read Southeast Asian names or anything like that, Asian names in general, it always fucks me up. It really does. Because I feel like I'm reading it right, but I also feel like, damn, I'm probably reading it wrong. And so, just off of that bit right there, Yasuke is a real person. And my definition of retainer at that time was a samurai. And so I'll read the rest too, because I feel like the rest is also maybe a little bit helpful. There are a few historical documents on Yasuke. From the fragmentary accounts, Yasuke first arrived in Japan in the service of Jesuit Alessandro Villinano. Alessandro Villinano. He was summoned to Nobunaga after Nobunaga wished to see a black man, which sounds so crazy, but 1581, you've never seen somebody with really dark skin. You probably want to see that person, I guess. After Nobunaga wished to see a black man, subsequently, Nobunaga took him into his service and gave him the name Yasuke. As a retainer, he was granted a stipend, a house, and a short sword. Yasuke accompanied Nobunaga until his death in the Honnoji incident. Afterwards, Yasuke was sent back to the Jesuits. There are no records of him afterwards. And so there is documents saying that this man actually existed. And doing my little bit of research, there's a bunch of people trying to debunk this in many ways, trying to use the lack of accounts for him in Japan as a means to say, well, he wasn't a samurai. There's no way he could have done this in such a short amount of time, and so on and so forth. To be honest, just assumptions. And so a lot of these things have actual references, and if you want to go check them out on Wikipedia, you can do that. Check out the validity of it. But regardless of whether he was real or not, he was real enough for Assassin's Creed to decide, hey, we're going to use this historical character in Yasuke as our protagonist in Assassin's Creed, because this is the angle we want to take in the game. And it has been so exhausting to see people online use this as another lame excuse to project their racism and hatred and bigotry and so on and so forth. And I'm really hoping that Assassin's Creed, like many other games, can just push through this and be the great game we all know it has the potential of being. With that said, I think the largest thing I'm wondering about this game, forget the Yasuke thing, I kind of just wanted to mention that because it's happening and it's relevant and it warrants mentioning, is what kind of game is this going to be? With Rise of the Ronin that recently came out on PlayStation, Rise of the Ronin, I think that's what it's called, and the aforementioned. Is aforementioned the right word? I'm so sorry. I have to do this sometimes. But with the legendary, the great game in Ghost of Tsushima, that recently just released on PC too, what kind of game is this gonna be? Is it gonna be heavily like Ghost of Tsushima? Because that's a tough game to try to replicate, being that. Being that, like, that for a lot of people is the game of that year, is the game of 2020. For me, that was my game of the year. And Final Fantasy VII Remake came out that year, so that's all you need to know. That is such a gem. Rise of the Ronin did not look like my kind of game, and I'm very much a samurai game kind of person, but I've also committed to I'm not buying brand new games unless I really want them, and the game just did not look appealing to me. And so I didn't buy into that. And so wondering if this is going to be anything like those games, because I feel like Rise of the Ronin has some slight Assassin's Creed elements to its like traversal and things of that nature. But what's the combat style going to be like? What's the story going to be like? With someone like Yasuke, because a black man in a feudal Japan carry something with that, you know what I mean? And so you have to play into that in the story. He can't just walk around like he's Japanese. He's not Japanese. How are people around him going to react? What's the story going to be around that? What is the connection between him and this other protagonist that we can play as? I'm not mistaken, this is not the first Assassin's Creed game to do that. And so, like, where are they going to take that? And so, I don't know, I'm really interested. I'm very excited to play an Assassin's Creed game that takes place in Japan. I've been a fan of the more recent Assassin's Creed game. You know, for all the shit I just gave Valhalla, it's a very fun game. I just cannot believe that I'm going to have to play that game for 70 hours to beat it, to get the full story. It's kind of crazy. But I'm also an even bigger fan of the early Assassin's Creed games. You know, Assassin's Creed, the first Assassin's Creed is not a perfect game, but it's a great game. And the Ezio storyline is like, Ezio is probably one of my favorite characters. He is one of my favorite video game characters of all time. And so, you know, is it going to play into that a little bit and the way that story was built and that world was built? I don't know. I'm super interested. And obviously, you know, how are the Templars coming into it all? You know, what is the game? What is the world outside of the feudal Japan world going to be like? Right. If I'm not mistaken, the machines they go into are called animuses. Right. Like, what's that world going to be like, the current world and so on and so forth? So I'm very interested to see how this all ties in. November 15th, right around the corner, I feel like less than 6 months from now, which is crazy. So that means basically tomorrow, the way time flies nowadays. Let me know in the comments if you're looking forward to Assassin's Creed and what you think about the controversy, if you have any thoughts at all. Last but not least, I wanted to get into recent news about Helldivers 2 sales and Square Enix's quote unquote multi-platform strategy. And so, like I said earlier, these are not two equal stories, but they sort of lean into the direction of something I like to talk about nowadays, which is games no longer being exclusive and what that world could possibly look like. And, you know, when there's sort of evidences or strong arguments for why we should start heading into that world, I feel like this is just something I'm maybe going to talk about a little bit here and there. And so earlier this month, PlayStation had its earnings call. And on that call, they announced that Helldivers 2 sold a massive 12 million copies across PS5 and PC, with most of that player base, very important, most of that player base being on PC. The rumor was that on PlayStation 5, it sold about 5 million copies. And so, give or take, there are 7 million people on PC playing Helldivers 2, which is staggering. You know, and, you know, like, just to get into that before we get into the Square Enix thing, what that makes me think about is, all right, cool. What are the people in the room over at PlayStation thinking to themselves now when they have put a multiplayer game day and date on PlayStation? Don't get me wrong, they already said that they were going to do day and date for multiplayer, right? Like, that was their goal, because for multiplayer, having the biggest player base possible is the aim. That is how you're going to succeed with those games. But I wonder if anybody in the room thought that they were going to sell more games on PC than they did on PS5. And even more so than that, if you followed the news and the zeitgeist that was Helldivers 2, a lot of that, I would argue most, if not all of that, was because of the PC. Because we didn't know what the player count was on PlayStation, right? We don't know how many people were trying to get on and playing concurrently over on PS5, but we knew that for Steam. You know, we had a basis, we had a reference for to be able to compare two other successful games on Steam. We had the SteamDB page that is showing us, oh, there's 80,000 people playing right now. Oh, there's 100,000 people right now. Oh, there's 240,000 people right now trying to play at the same goddamn time. And a lot of that was stirring conversation. A lot of that was showing how absolutely popular this game was and how much of a must play it really, really was. And part of me wonders, and I imagine there's people at PlayStation wondering the same thing, if this game doesn't come out on PC and it is a PS5 exclusive, do we sell 12 million units? The answer to that is absolutely not. I don't even think that that's a debate. You don't sell 12 million units without this game on PC. But the question I find myself asking, now is, would you have even sold 5 million copies if it wasn't for PC? Now, don't get me wrong. I'm a PlayStation 5 owner who has a PC. I opted to buy it on PC because that's where I prefer to play my shooters. I'm a keyboard and mouse guy. And so I imagine there's a lot of people like that, that have PS5s and have a PC, you know, like, and there's a whole bunch of people like that, that especially the people who talk about nobody has an Xbox. Why do I need an Xbox when I can just buy a PC? So I imagine there's a whole bunch of people who have PS5s and PCs. But do I go out and run to buy Helldivers 2? If we don't have SteamDB numbers for news outlets to consistently make articles talking about this game, do the servers overflow at any point in time that make people feel like, damn, there's a lot of people playing this right now. Like, this is great. I'm not sure. Because a lot of what sells a game is that initial zeitgeist. If you don't have an all-time great game, if you don't have a Grand Theft Auto, if you don't have a God of War, if you don't have a Spider-Man, if you don't have a Last of Us, if you don't have these premier titles, you don't have a Horizon, that initial launch window is your window. Like, that is your time to make sales, to make money. Helldivers was not some incredible franchise before Helldivers 2 that everybody was on the edge, you know, can't wait for this to come out, can't wait to play this. That was not the sentiment around Helldivers 2. Helldivers 2 was like, man, this game looks pretty cool. Wonder what it's going to be like, you know? And looking forward to seeing what people have to say about it to see if I'm going to buy it. And it helped a ton that that game was only $40. I think that's another big reason why a lot of people just went out and bought it, because it wasn't too big of a commitment. You know, $40, and a lot of people are having fun with it. There's a lot of people playing with it. So many people that I can't even get on because the servers are full. Let me go cop that. And I feel like those 7 million people who bought it on PC had a whole lot to do with why a big number of that 5 million people on PS5 went out and bought the game. And I personally do not think that the game even sells 5 million copies without PC. Without PC creating the conversation, without PC throwing fuel to the flame of that zeitgeist that was Helldivers 2 in late February, that game don't even sell 5 million units. And they went out and sold 12 because of that. And when you look at past launches of PlayStation games, even more recently, like Ghost of Tsushima, that game ain't sell millions and millions of units on PC, you know? Maybe they sold a million, you know what I mean? I think the concurrent count was upwards of like 70,000, 80,000 people at a time. That's quite a lot of people. But we've seen God of War numbers. We've seen the Horizon numbers. We've seen the Spider-Man numbers. They're not staggering sales numbers for a game that came out years ago that they're now porting to PC. Because again, that zeitgeist has a lot to do with the sales of a game. Now, imagining there are many people like me who have a PS5, and when that game came out on PlayStation, I bought it on PlayStation. I'm not buying it again on PC. I'm not going to buy it again on PC. And I'm sure that if the game did launch day and date, maybe I would have bought it on PC instead of PlayStation. That doesn't necessarily give them more sales, right? So I'm sure there's going to be situations like that. But I'm wondering how many people aren't buying the game because there is no zeitgeist around it. You know, like, there is a large component of a game's release that is FOMO, the feeling of missing out. There are tons of people out there who buy a game on launch because they want to be part of that lunch. They want to be part of that conversation. They want to review a game when everybody's talking about it. They want to play that multiplayer game while it's still hot. You know what I mean? They don't want to play a multiplayer game months later after months when the only people who are playing that game are like really avid fans of that game, and they are so much better than you are because there are rarely any new people playing the game at this point. You know, and so FOMO has a large part to do with why people buy games at launch and why people want to buy games near launch and why they don't buy them after it's been months and years since they've launched. Also because, well, there's new games to play. Why would I go and buy a game that's 4, 5, 6, 7 years old when I can play a game that just came out? You know? And so I think Helldivers 2, I gotta imagine that PlayStation's looking at it like, man, this is a real big example of why we need to start launching day and date on PC for everything and not just multiplayer games. I feel like multiplayer games, oh man, this is a no-brainer. PlayStation is never releasing another multiplayer game again that's not coming out on PC first, on day and date. But I think this game was so successful that they must be having conversations internally of what single player game are they willing to launch day and date to test those waters. Because you gotta see, you cannot continue living in this world of, oh, what if? Nah, you need to know what is going to happen if we release a single player game day and date on PC. You got to see that success through. And so I'm wondering what's happening with that, right? And then also like the Square Enix thing, I actually want to read it verbatim from a IGN article because they put it really well. The title is Final Fantasy Maker Square Enix Will Aggressively Pursue a Multi-Platform Strategy After Profits Tumble. And so the section I just want to read off, it's just a small bit. It reads, in response to the tumbling profits, Square Enix announced what it calls, quote unquote, Square Enix Reboots and Awakens, a 3-year plan for rebooting for long-term growth. This involves a rethink across all parts of the business, but the highlight is a, quote unquote, shift to a multi-platform strategy. Square Enix said it will, quote unquote, aggressively pursue a multi-platform strategy that includes Nintendo platforms, PlayStation, Xbox, and PCs. As part of this multi-platform strategy, Square Enix said it will build an environment where more customers can enjoy titles in regards to major franchises and AAA titles, including catalog titles, so games that they've already released. The suggestion in all this is mainline Final Fantasy games will ditch PlayStation exclusivity going forward, although Square Enix has yet to announce specifics beyond Final Fantasy XVI's upcoming launch on PC. And so, man, I think that's huge. You know, like, the point I keep thinking about with this is like, Square Enix is one of the bigger publishers that has had a more prominent exclusivity deal. You know, like there's Call of Duty has some marketing exclusivity deals with PlayStation and things of that nature. There's like smaller JRPGs, and you know, Square Enix has got a bunch of games that are exclusive to the Switch, but they are not Final Fantasy. You know what I mean? They're smaller titles that might be like Final Fantasy, might be, you know, turn-based, it might be this, it might be that, but it is not a juggernaut like a Final Fantasy. You know, there's 16 Final Fantasies for a reason, I'd like to think. And so when you hear that, well, you know what? A publisher like that has relied heavily on that, right? Like, you think about how many Final Fantasy games are anywhere else, and the recent ones aren't on Nintendo consoles. You know, other than 15 and 13, there are none on Xbox. You know what I mean? And some of the later ones have come to Nintendo. You know, the first ones were on Nintendo eventually, but then that PlayStation exclusivity started with 7 and they never turned back, you know? And it isn't until recently where they ported those games over to Nintendo and other platforms like PC that we've seen those games leave PlayStation. And so to hear that a publisher as prominent as Square Enix, with an exclusivity deal as prominent as the Final Fantasy exclusivity deals that they've had with PlayStation, might come to an end, that's huge. And I don't think it's just huge for them. I think it's huge for anyone who might be interested in having deals like this in the future, and saying to themselves, well, if Square's not doing it anymore, why are we doing it? And so, just because I wrote it down here and I don't want to lose my thought, I wrote my bullet point says, as someone who doesn't really care for exclusive, this is refreshing to see. And then the bullet point I put under it reads, although I understand the reason to opening up their games to other platforms, quote unquote, more money, like, why now? Hasn't that always been the case, right? Like, because my thought is, like, hasn't it always been the case that you could make more money by putting your games on more platforms? Like, was the exclusivity deal that good? Like, was PlayStation paying out that much money? Is Nintendo paying out that much money for you to have these games exclusive to their platforms and not sell them to anyone else? Are they that lucrative? And I guess at some point they must have been, but then it makes me think, are they no longer that lucrative? And so that, just to continue on from what I'm saying, like, hasn't that always been the case? Couldn't you always get more money before? Next question, are the exclusive deals not good enough anymore? Or the last one, which is the PC market that untapped nowadays? Are console players shifting to PC? And so, because that's the only place I can sort of like get to now, where it's like, all right, the deals must have been lucrative enough back in the days for a Square Enix to find enough of a reason to say, you know what? Yeah, you can have this game and we won't sell it anywhere else. And the same goes for everyone else, right? You could toss us the bag and y'all can have the game. Like, we don't need to sell it anywhere else if this is what you're giving us. But then it leads me to think, like, all right, the deal must not be good enough anymore. Why isn't it good enough anymore? Is the number not adding up anymore? Like, is what they're offering and paying out not stacking up to what your projections of what your sales could have been are? And why is that? Is it because there is a fan base on an Xbox who wants this game? Is there a fan base on a future Nintendo title that's a Nintendo's console that's good enough to run a current gen Final Fantasy want this title? And is the PC market now big enough? Because that's the other platform that's good enough to run these games, right? Good enough to run a Rebirth at high fidelity, good enough to run a Final Fantasy 16 at high fidelity, right? That PC game is coming. It's already announced, right? They've been talking about it. Is that market that untapped now? And if it's that untapped now, was it not always that way? Were there not enough PC players that would want this game that warranted you going and making it for that platform? Which makes me think, like, man, the shift to PC must really be real. And not just in my generation as millennials, as like people who are just grown up, have a little extra money and are like, you know what, I'm gonna go build a high-end PC so I can play games the best way possible. But is that a new generation, a younger generation that is choosing PC over consoles? I think about my nephew and how badly he wanted a PC. He has consoles. That's fine and all. But guess what? He doesn't talk about his consoles to me. He talks about his PC. And so does this show that a new generation of gamers is leaning toward another platform so heavily that it is no longer lucrative to make these exclusive deals with a console maker? And I don't know what the answer is, but I do know that based on these two things, Helldivers selling more units on PC, a PlayStation exclusive game selling more games on a platform that is not PlayStation, and Square Enix coming out and literally saying, yeah, we're changing our strategy and we're going to sell our games in more places because that's what makes sense for us right now. Those things are telling me a story, and it is that the console market does not have the stranglehold on gaming that it once had. And these gamers, new and old, are going to other places to get their enjoyment that is gaming. And a lot of that is PC. I mean, I grew up a console guy myself, but I also grew up with a PC at home. I just also knew that my PC didn't have the games I wanted to play, and also my compact gateway PC didn't. Compact gateway. I can't believe that, man. I'm aging myself right now. My gateway, my compact didn't wasn't powerful enough to play a lot of games. And I also understood that, like, that's not where all my friends were playing. That's not where all the people I knew were playing. They were playing on console. I very much knew that as a PC gamer then, I was a hardcore gamer playing on PC back in the late 90s, early 2000s. And today, that does not make you a hardcore gamer. That just makes you a gamer. And I think that says more than anything about where gaming is going and where a lot of these companies, PlayStation, Square Enix, Microsoft already, potentially one day Nintendo, where they see eyeballs, attention, which ultimately means money, is going. And where the money goes, they will go because money make the world go round. Anyways, and so yeah, that's my thoughts on that. I kind of just wanted to talk about those two things because I think they speak heavily to the direction that gaming is going. Like, man, we might one day live in a world where outside of Nintendo, because who the hell knows what those guys over there are going to do? They making hand over fist money over there. Shoot, they put out a chart with the sales of all their games on Switch, and I couldn't even believe what I was reading. Oh my God, they're making money over there. But yeah, outside of them, are games gonna be exclusive anymore? And you know, I was wrong about the 10 minutes, but Perdida is at the door, just like I said. But you know what? She's staying out there until this episode's over, because we're almost done anyways. And so those were four main stories for today, and I just have a few honorable mentions. We'll go through them really quickly. So the first one is Astro Bot is rumored to get a new game, and it's not going to be a PSVR game apparently. And why the hell would it be, to be honest with you? PlayStation VR, what a joke. If you don't know, if you don't have a PS5 at least, because it came with the PS5, Astro Bot has a pack-in game with the PS5, and it is phenomenal. It is pretty much just like a, you know, to show you what the PS5 is all about, you know, show you everything that the controller can do, everything that the console can do, so on and so forth. But that game was so much fun. Honestly, it's probably one of the best PS5 games I've played, and it was a pack-in game, which is bananas. It reminds me of how good the demos that used to come with older PlayStations were. Man, what a time to be alive. And so I'm looking forward to that, actually. Hopefully that does get announced soon, because I would love to see what that looks like. Next is Nintendo said that they will talk about their next console by the end of this fiscal year, which ends in April 2025, if I'm not mistaken. So, or March 2025, one of those two. I think it's March 2025, because that's a end of a quarter. So basically, before April 2025, we should know about the next Nintendo console. And that is exciting, like really, really exciting. And like, no more rumors, no more speculations, no more is it coming? Like, no, it's coming. They said themselves it's coming, and we're gonna talk about it in the next year. And so I don't know. Looking forward to what it's gonna be like. Rumors are that it's gonna be as powerful as a Series S console. It's gonna be 1080p handheld, 4K docked. Not really sure why a Nintendo Switch is gonna be 4K, but whatever, we'll see. Hopefully it just has better battery life, better Joy-Cons. 1080p screen sounds good to me. And yeah, as powerful as the Series S, that means it's gonna play some pretty good games, which was probably the most disappointing thing about the current Switch, for all it's worth. And last but not least, Doom the Dark Ages is being heavily rumored to be announced at the Xbox Game Showcase on June 9th. I just thought that was a interesting one because Doom is a huge franchise, and it's like the one game that has been like talked about the most that it's actually coming in that Xbox showcase. So I thought it was worth mentioning. And y'all, that is episode 5 of We Talk About Games. You know, now at the end of the episode, just full disclosure, I had already recorded episode 5 weeks ago. Like, I actually recorded 3 weeks in a row. But I hated so much how that episode came out that I ended up not posting it. And I feel like the universe punished me by making it so difficult to not record again for the next month and a half. And so I think moving forward, regardless of how bad I think an episode is, how much better it could be. Because, I mean, looking back on it, it really wasn't even that bad. You know, it just wasn't what I wanted. And I gotta stop being hard on myself, I guess. And so, you know, here's to the what ended up really being episode 5. And looking forward to seeing you guys here for episode 6 next week. And so, on that note, you know, if you're watching on YouTube, hit that subscribe button, leave a comment, let me know what you think of any of these things that I brought up. If there's anything you want me to talk about next week, there is a Google Form link in the bio of the podcast on podcast services and on YouTube. Click that and send in your thoughts for the next episode. I gotta do a better job of sharing that link before I record so that people can get their thoughts in ahead of the episode. So I have some of those to talk about and I can actually use them. But that's neither here nor there. But yeah, on that note, an hour and 15 minutes in, I really try to get these episodes in under an hour, but seems impossible. It really, really does seem impossible. On that note, I hope y'all have a wonderful day, afternoon, evening, weekday, weekend, whenever and wherever you might be listening to this. And on that note, deuces.